1. New voice message.
Hi, Maya. Oh my gosh, this is so cool. So my name is Brooke, and I read The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon when I was 11 years old, and it's one of my favorites of his. I'm 20 now, and I do think that if I were to reread it now, I wouldn't love it as much. When I was 11, I was definitely going through a rough time. I was starting to deal with a lot of anxiety, and this is one of my favorites of Stephen King's books, is because it did kind of showcase, you know, a young girl who was struggling, and she needed to figure out a way of how to get through this situation. And I think that's definitely something he did really well. Compared to his other books, it's definitely not on the same level. And, you know, something that's probably not going to appeal to a lot of his more, like, crazy horror fans. But personally, I think it's a really good book. I think it's definitely worth a read, even if it might not be your cup of tea. Thank you so much for letting me be a part of this. And, yeah, bye.
End of message.
Did you know there are other worlds in these, where they all float or get a bad disease? Let's all go to Castle Rock. We can hitch a ride with Christine, and you will find the Dairy Connection, and we can party like it's 6/19/99.
You want to say that thing about being married to me?
I mean, if you were a good audio engineer, you already would have been recording, so we would have captured it.
That's true. Okay.
Hello. That's going to stay in the show. I am back after an extremely long hiatus. I think the last time that I published an episode of Dairy Connection was maybe a year ago.
It's been that long?
It's maybe been longer. I'm not sure. Here's the thing about me. I hate editing audio, so I actually have like 3 episodes in the pipe. This one will probably get published in like 2 years. I'll try my best. We'll see what happens.
Oh, man. What if one of us dies between now and then?
I will aim to get it out before any of us are dead.
No, I just mean like, then we'll have a voice from beyond the grave.
Ooh, maybe I'll wait for that. Oh, also, it's Friday the 13th.
I know. Perfect.
Which I think is a good, that's a good anchor.
It's me. I'm Eric. I'm dead.
Because when this does get published, we'll be like,
everyone
wow, when was the last
headphones.
Friday the 13th?
Ooh, yeah.
That was years ago.
What if we all die and then someone finds this audio file?
Ooh, like The Handmaid's Ooh. Tale.
Like Blair Witch.
Anyway, to finish my intro.
Which Blair?
No. So as a reminder, this is a Stephen King podcast, everyone. That's what we talk about here. But I'm back because, well, I love doing the show. I love talking about Stephen King. But also, I have been getting a lot of complaints from people who discover my show, get super excited, and then yell at me about not having new episodes.
Haters.
Are you doing sound effects? Is that... So
settle
the
down.
Bomb noise. Yeah.
when my friend and coworker Anna told me that she wanted to read her first ever Stephen King book,
oh.
I said, "Great, stop doing sound
this
effects.
This is your first one?
That's my first one.
Let me finish a sentence. I'm still doing the intro. I'm the host.
You didn't say there was a policy that we couldn't speak before being introduced. If you had said that,
we're getting introduced.
Yes, hold on.
Oh, wow.
All right. Ooh. When Anna, I'm trying to set myself up for a joke here, and you're ruining the punchline.
Anna, you can speak. You've been mentioned.
Shut up. I love being married. It's really wonderful. When Anna told me that she wanted to read her first ever Stephen King book, I said, great, I'll help you pick one out. You can be on my podcast. And she said, okay, just give me your favorite one. And so I brought her a hardcover copy of The Stand. And she was like, oh boy, I did not know it was going to be that big. And she tried. How far did you make it in?
No, it's sitting on my shelf.
But you started it, right? Oh. Yeah, okay.
I'm sorry.
But you didn't start it. It's like the
it's
best
so good.
Book ever.
I really want to read it because it's the plague one, right? Because
yeah.
I think
yes,
we talked
yes,
about
yes,
it,
yes.
And I said I love plague literature.
It's
you
so
will
good.
Love it. It
and
is
so
the ultimate plague.
I didn't finish it.
I know I'm going to love it. I know I'm going to love it, but it was daunting.
Yeah. So months later, Anna came to me and said, actually, let's do Tom Gordon, one of the shortest ever Stephen King books, and that's why we're here.
All right.
Sounds about right. Yeah, it was because one of my favorite authors, Karen Russell, mentioned it out of the blue at a reading that I went to with her. And so, and she was like, this is, you know, she was talking about her influences. She writes these really weird, like quasi-horror stories.
Ooh.
Not exactly, but they're just like very whimsical and fun, but also quite a bit of body horror. And anyway, and she cited this particular book as one that she thinks is pretty influential. So
for body horror?
Not even for that, just like in terms that. of the
Are you into body horror?
No.
What are you gonna do?
Body horror is like the one place I can't go with horror.
I agree. So I wanna clarify, I realize this is not a Karen Russell podcast, but she doesn't exactly do, like, for instance, one of her most recent stories is about a tree inhabiting the body.
That's not what I was thinking.
Exactly. It's a little different. But she, or like people turning into silkworms.
Okay.
She does some interesting stuff. Anyway, she referenced it and I was like, ooh, okay, Stephen King. That's perfect. And so let's read it.
And Duncan is also here, giggling for some reason.
Just such a begrudging. And I gotta talk about this guy now.
You guys have been pretty annoying for the last 20 minutes, but we'll get into it. It's cool. We'll get there. Duncan, one of our best friends, has been trying to get me to read Tom Gordon for many years. Yes, you have too, Duncan. You told me it was your favorite book when you were in middle school.
That is true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you were like, you got to read Tom. Oh, maybe you weren't telling me to read it, but you kept talking about how it was
yeah, I'm sure
to be your
if
favorite.
You had talked to me when I was 12, I would have encouraged you to read Tom Gordon.
In a way, I have.
Fair enough.
And my loving husband is here giving me a real hard time because
hey,
I forgot to bring home headphones.
If anybody's wondering why the audio sounds so good on this episode, it's because of me. I read this book. I read it 19 years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I don't remember a single thing about it other than that I did not like it. Girl walking through the woods, here's the radio, baseball player, yada, yada, boom, it's over. That's all I remember.
It's a pretty good synopsis.
Yeah, you're not missing a whole lot.
I read this book. Can I tell a little tale?
A short one.
No, I don't really have a tale. But I read this because I used to read Stephen King when I was in elementary school, and I was just completely obsessed with him at the time. Mm. And after high school, I was doing a bunch of traveling, and I ended up in Florida. And while I was traveling, I would frequently pick up books that kind of like reminded me of stuff that I was into. And often it was like TV or so, like, I remember when I was traveling, I found an X-Files novelization. So it was like an X-Files episode, but in a book. Mm. And I read that and loved it, like tore through it. And I had that same feeling. I still remember like walking up to the bookshelf and seeing the cover of this book. What's this book called?
The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon.
I'm
and
like,
seeing the cover of my favorite book.
Yeah, I'm just like,
what was it called?
I'm like, that Tom Gordon book. And it's like, you know, it's like the girl, it's like the, but she's like walking into the forest, right? Yeah. And it's like the woods, and it has like that kind of like, you know, the cover is sort of like this gentle woodsy kind of look. And I was like, oh, not that one. Let me see that one. Can you,
does that bring it
back
for you?
That's not the one that I picked
up. Okay. Are you thinking of a different book?
There might've been
no.
OG.
No, I can confirm that the copy of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon I had in seventh grade is neither of the covers that we have in front
yeah,
of us.
Yeah. The one that you're holding, that's like the trade paperback. That's the one like after they do hardcover, then paperback, then it's sort of like the cheap paperbacks. That's that one. But like, there's always that like nice presentation of the paperback at first. That's the one I remember looking at. And there was something about like the gentle greens and stuff. And I was like living in Florida, so I was far from home. And I was like, Stephen King, you know, you take me back all these years. Like, this is going to feel like home. I'm going to read it. And I read it and I was like, what did you just do to me, man?
Mm.
So
is it this?
No.
Wow. Incredibly horrible cover.
Radioactive green.
No, that wasn't it.
It was the gentle.
Well, that's all I got.
But yeah.
Eye-burning green.
I remember I was working at a bookstore and you were allowed to borrow books. And I was like walking around and I saw, it had just come out. When did this book come out? Do you know? 2000?
1999.
So it was probably brand new. And I remember thinking like, oh, a little piece of home.
Duncan, do you know why this came out in 1999?
No.
It came out on the opening day of the Red Sox's 99 season.
It seems like that could have applied to any year.
Yeah. I should have said, do you know day it came out?
I was searching my brain.
Well, I think I was thinking maybe there was like an amazing year in 99.
Here we are,
think
entering year 10 of the Red Sox season.
Because you know that there's a Major League Baseball season every year, right?
What's baseball?
Well, is this now the time to talk about Tom Gordon?
Oh my God, you're
right,
giving Duncan the green light to talk about baseball.
We can talk about Tom Gordon, but I just want to say first, maybe like I came into this not knowing anything about baseball or Tom Gordon. What about you, Anna?
Oh, absolutely nothing about baseball
nothing.
Or Tom Gordon.
Couldn't tell you.
Frankly, I like the version of Tom Gordon that I got to imagine
yeah.
as like
a
sort of an
character.
OG Patronus.
Yes.
not, yeah.
He was like a Patronus.
I know. I have that written down.
Before Harry Potter.
Yeah.
What's a Patronus?
Yeah, Eric is going to need some background on this
Eric
one.
Hates Harry Potter, so. Yeah,
I don't hate Harry Potter. That is not true. That is not true. That is a
He doesn't care.
Spicy take.
I do not hate Harry Potter.
10 minutes in.
a Patronus is a spiritual familiar specific to an individual that helps them ward off evil.
Okay.
I feel like a generalization that's not Harry Potter specific for what a Patronus is.
Yeah, totally. And it's like that you conjure. I think that's also specific to that. They sort of use it, not in the same way as a spell, but you bring it forth.
Okay, you can't just keep telling stories about your youth. Is that what you're talking
to? No. I was just going to say that this reminds me of a concept from the Church of the Subgenius, which is called the Shudder Persav, and is the short duration personal savior. And you're allowed to conjure this individual in times of need or crisis, and they get you through it, and then you
like Tom Gordon.
It makes like a lot of sense. It's like, or a guardian angel or any sort of. It's that archetype.
Yeah.
A Pokemon, maybe.
Wait, can I just hear, so going around, does everyone hate this book?
Yes.
I liked this book.
I feel mostly negative, but there were parts I liked.
Okay. That's so interesting. Okay. Overall, I felt positive, like not rave reviews, like, wow, this is my favorite book, but I actually felt good about this book.
I would love for you to read a different Stephen King book and see if you like it even more.
This is what I'm wondering is like, is the reason that people don't like it because they're using the metric of I'm looking for a Stephen King book. And I was like, I don't know what a Stephen King book is. Yeah. So I'm just going to read this book. And it's
absolutely
kind of interesting.
I'm going to soften my criticism a bit by saying that like the reason I was so disappointed by it was that at the time I was looking for that thing I was familiar with. And that's a Stephen King story. Mm. And this just, it felt sort of like cheap. Like it just felt like he didn't spend a lot of time on it, you know? Like it didn't have his depth that you normally get in a story.
I actually felt like, I'm gonna change my review. I didn't hate it. It just wasn't my favorite one, but I thought it was a really good illustration of what Stephen King is good at, which is turning something totally neutral into something terrifying.
Oh my God, yeah.
And I felt the same way reading this as I did Christine. Christine is an objectively terrible book, but it's still like, it's a page turner. You wanna see what happens. And the descriptions of all the people, it's like, I didn't really care about this particular story. Like it wasn't epic like his usually are, but like I felt like I could picture her family and I was really worried about what was going to happen to her.
Yeah.
And like that's something that I think he's very good at. I think it's just like I don't care about baseball or the woods, so there was a lot that I was kind of like, okay, hard to identify with. But
yeah, I think this is like a good pulp book in that it like moves along at a pretty good clip. Yeah. All the themes are very obvious. It's short. It doesn't really leave you thinking about that much, I don't think, but it's like fun to read while you're reading it.
Yeah.
I think that's maybe what turned me off, because the thing with Stephen King,
that it was
King,
fun to read.
No. That it is so quick and direct. Whereas like most of Stephen King, like, I mean, a lot of people criticize Stephen King for just sort of like wandering and being very purple with his prose. And like, that's what I love about Stephen King. Like I get so into his head while he's writing. And this is just kind of like, all right, we're walking through the woods, blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's hilarious because... This is incredible. I really obviously need to read other Stephen King books. No, because no. As I was reading it, I was like, wow, I'm just flying through this. I was like, I guess this is part of the Stephen King thing. Is you just whip through it because every sentence just waterfalls into the next one, which I was actually really impressed by because I don't know. I feel like I, as a writer, tend to get really caught up in the description. And so reading somebody who's just like so plot driven of every single thing, I mean, it just doesn't stop moving, which I thought was kind of cool.
Meanwhile, The Stand gathers dust on your bookshelf.
But The Stand is the same way. Like, it's very long, but there's never a moment where you're bored. It's so... Yeah. Okay. There were moments when Duncan was born.
Well, I should also clarify that I accidentally picked up the, like, author's cut version of The Stand, which is 300 extra pages.
My God.
And it's not clear what those 300 pages extra are, but whatever editor removed them for the... version that was originally published clearly knew what they were doing.
And I love The Stand so much. I would love to read 300 more pages of it.
That's the one that I reread and I loved it.
Did I read that one or did I just read? I think I just read the original. I don't know. Oh my God, I loved it so much.
I think I have it on my bookshelf. The last 400 pages are untouched. You're welcome to borrow it.
I mean, you know.
That's the book I should have read, huh?
I mean, it's very good.
All right,
I'm also worried I'm coming off as kind of a Stephen King hater, which will not be well received by the audience of this podcast.
Yeah, you are kind of the villain of this episode.
So I should... Right, it's me in first place, but and I'm second place is the wasp creature.
Yes.
The wasp priest.
The god of the lost.
Well, the wasp priest and the wasp bear are two different entities.
Oh, I'm sorry. You were talking about
the
creature.
Or the bear?
Yeah, wow. Spoiler
I was thinking
alert.
Of the bear. I think the bear is the main antagonist.
Yeah. Yes. Or rather, the god of the lost inhabiting the bear.
Yes.
But in terms of my other Stephen King experiences, the second book in the Dark Tower series is one of the greatest books I've ever read.
How did you like the fifth book?
I stopped reading the series after about 30 pages into the fifth book.
Yo, how'd you guys like that movie?
Ooh, that was a turd.
We actually don't talk about that movie on this podcast.
I mean, that
we
was
don't acknowledge
a fun
it.
2 hours for me because we were all drinking whiskey in the theater.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we went together.
Yeah.
It was terrible.
It was one of the worst movies
really,
I've ever
really
seen.
Terrible.
I feel like once we realized it was terrible, it was somewhat liberating though, right?
Yeah.
There was a freeing moment where we were like, we all sort of looked at each other like, this is not working out at all, right?
Like, it's not worth trying to untangle whatever they're doing. All right, let's talk about baseball.
Okay.
I don't know anything about baseball.
Yeah, so let's.
I have no idea who Tom Gordon is. Is he alive? Does he still play baseball?
Tom Gordon is still alive. He is retired.
Is he married?
I do not know.
He must feel pretty cool.
He's married to Trisha McFarland.
Whoa. Yeah.
That's a great question, is how did Tom Gordon feel about this book?
I mean, he must feel really cool, right? Like somebody wrote a book where he's just...
I'm pretty sure I saw somewhere, I didn't write it down, but I saw somewhere that they did get his sign off before they made it about him. Like Stephen King wanted to write a book about the Red Sox and asked Tom Gordon's permission to make it about him.
Is Stephen King a big Red Sox fan?
That is an understatement.
Okay.
Stephen King, basically the only thing he cares about is the Red Sox.
Wow.
And, you know, writing books, I guess, but...
I wish that I liked baseball.
Because Stephen King does?
No, I mean, Stephen King's cool, and it would be, like, a great opportunity for us to talk about a shared interest if I did like baseball.
When you see him.
Yeah. It seems like something that there's an incredible depth to, but I don't know how to get to it.
Yeah, you're just not a sports person.
Is that what it is?
Yes.
It's just that I can't crack it because I don't have that in me?
I think that even among sports, baseball is the hardest to achieve an appreciation for.
Yeah.
Because there are plenty of sports people that are like, yeah, I can watch football 3 days a week and 12 hours on Sundays, and you couldn't sit me down for an inning of baseball because it's too slow.
Yeah.
I also wonder if it was something specific about Tom Gordon as the baseball player, or if he was just like, oh, this is the Red Sox closer when I'm writing this book. Like, if he had written it a decade later, would it be the girl who loved
Jonathan
Applebaum?
I think
Jonathan
that's what
Applebaum?
It was, yeah. I think it was just he was someone who stood out on the Sox.
Right, because I did wonder about that. Is he, when he's talking about like the stillness of Tom Gordon before the pitch, is that
Stephen
like the
King
platonic version?
Anyone.
Exactly. Is that the like idealized version of what he imagines?
I bet
is
he
the
really
perfect
did it. But
pre-pitch?
I bet Stephen King could have taken like a quirk from anybody and made it seem like religious thing.
Yeah. Well,
this like the way the story is structured and the way that Tom Gordon plays into it, it's important for it to be a closing pitcher because a lot of it is about how like God shows up in the
ninth inning,
third out of the ninth inning.
If it were a different kind of Red Sox player, the story would still be religious, just in a different way.
Right. It's just
I still
like,
think he could.
But you're right because of the save and the
The important contribution of like a shortstop doesn't come right at the end.
I disagree. I think Stephen King could have made a compelling story about a shortstop or like a blind catcher.
But we're talking about this particular story.
Yeah, I'm sure Stephen King could write an interesting story about a rock on the beach.
It's called Duma Key.
It wouldn't be called The Girl Who Loved a Rock on the Beach.
Yeah, listens
to her radio about a rock
she's
on the
it.
Beach.
She's got it.
Okay, so just a little bit of MLB background on Tom Gordon, so we're all on the same page about him.
Is he cute or not?
Yeah, he's a cutie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. You were going to show us the photo.
I mean, it's just his Wikipedia picture.
I'm just going to Google it while you talk.
That's
go ahead.
Okay. I want to get eyes on Tom Gordon.
So he's what you might call a journeyman pitcher. He played 11 years in Major League Baseball.
Oh,
he was on,
super cute.
Can I see?
No.
He was on 8 different teams over the course of that. So it's not like the kind of thing where he played.
Imagine this guy saving you in the woods. I love his entire career.
For
we're
one
all
team.
Listening. I'm just impressed
no,
how cute he is.
You're looking at Tom Gordon. I understand. And as they say in the book, every baseball player is handsome in his own way. So I get that.
Yeah. They do say that.
But yeah, so he was on the Red Sox for 3 years. 1998 was his first year. So this would have been, it's not like he was a Red Sox institution when Stephen King was writing this book or when it was published. And as it comes up several times in the book, Trisha says that God is not a Red Sox fan. And that was because the Red Sox had not won a World Series for close to a century when this was published.
The curse. Yeah.
They would go on to win the World Series 5 years later. But this was after Tom Gordon was off the team. But he did win the World Series with the Philadelphia Phillies in 2008, shortly before retiring. So he is a World Series champion, but not with the team he was on when this book was written.
Do you know what else happened
in
2004?
And a total cue. cutie.
Super cute. In 2004, when the Red Sox broke that curse, is it their curse or the Yankees' curse? Theirs, right?
Yeah, it's theirs.
Didn't something happen with Babe Ruth and then they were cursed and then...
So the year that they traded Babe Ruth to the Yankees...
That's what it is.
...is when the curse of the Bambino, started.
I remember that,
was not
frequency.
Broken until 2004. Yeah.
Well, in 2004, Stephen King actually released another book about the Red Sox that he wrote with one of his friends, and it's a nonfiction book about how much they love the Red Sox.
Oh, who did he write that
the
with?
The me who loved
it was,
Tom Gordon.
Somebody I know.
His name's like Nan something or something O'Nan or...
I thought it was...
Hold on, I'll tell you.
I thought it was a writer that I was familiar with. Maybe it's not.
Another potentially relevant detail about Tom Gordon's life is that he grew up in abject poverty to the point that his family did not even have a telephone.
Aww.
So it's cool that he was able to succeed in Major League Baseball and become a millionaire several times
that's
over.
That's really cool.
Because of those talents.
I think I'm a Tom Gordon fan.
Yeah.
Are you the girl who
loves Tom Gordon? We're all girls who love Tom Gordon today.
Yeah.
Wow.
I am definitely a girl who loves Tom Gordon. And that story about a baseball player is even better than the only story about baseball players that I know, which is the movie Major League.
I don't know anything about baseball. I like the snacks. I like the community and I like the snacks.
You get
that's
hot
my
dogs,
feeling about
you get
it.
Nachos.
And here's the thing I like. I like
nice
that everybody has
beer.
To pass your food to you and pass your money.
That is
and
fun.
There's such a high, it's a high trust environment.
The co-writer was Stuart O'Nan, who I've never heard of.
Never heard of him. I thought.
And I will never read this book. Don't care.
Yeah, wait, I have another bit of, so actually I'm changing topics from Tom Gordon.
I'm sorry to cut you off.
You got
there,
another baseball
Maya,
fact?
Well, Maya just said that there was a Stephen King book that she would refuse to read, which I think
I don't
is
need to read his nonfiction.
But
I'm not interested. I also
on.
Haven't read On Writing. And
oh, it's so good. Oh my God, it's so good.
I don't care.
You don't have
to
be a writer.
I just want to enjoy the output.
Because it's not about writing per se. It's autobiographical.
Sure it's maybe when I finish all of his fiction works, I will read On Writing. And maybe after that, I'll read this baseball one. But it seems unlikely. I'll just find a new favorite author.
On Writing is so good.
I'll just find a new favorite
You
author.
Should read On Writing, though, Anna.
I have been meaning to. I've heard it's really good.
It's beautiful. It's an easy read, too. It's very short. Oh, my God. It's so good.
Can I tell my Stephen King baseball story?
I would love.
Oh, yeah. Banger.
Okay. All right. So Eric and I went to Bangor, Maine, where Stephen King, I still don't know how to pronounce Bangor. I do it wrong every time.
Bangor. That's how I say it. That's got to be wrong.
I don't know. It's like Bangor. It's not. Yeah, whatever.
Banger.
That's not how they say it.
Bangor.
We went there for the Stephen King tour. We also got engaged on that trip, as I'm sure I've mentioned on every episode of this podcast. one of the things that they showed on the tour, and the guy who runs the tour has lived there his whole life. He knows Stephen King. He's been to a bunch of the premieres. Mm-hmm. He grew up there.
Calls him Steve, acts like they're best friends.
Definitely is not actually best friends with him.
Definitely questionable.
Also, if he's listening though, it was a wonderful tour.
Love the tour.
Yeah.
And thank you for that amazing photo.
Oh my God, our engagement photo. He didn't even know that was our engagement photo.
Yeah, he had no idea that was our engagement photo.
And it's good. Anyway, one of the stops on the tour was the Little League Stadium in Bangor, which is amazing because Stephen King has put millions of dollars into the Bangor Little League situation.
Wow.
So he paid to rebuild their whole stadium. He goes to every game.
Also the local library.
Yeah, also the local library. But it was just so cute because I don't remember exactly what the story is. Maybe you do, but it was something about he reinvigorated this town's Little League. And so all of these Little League players see him as this hero who has brought this back to their town.
Yeah. And so if I remember this correctly, it might be wrong if somebody from up there is listening.
We definitely do have some Maine fans.
Okay. So I might be wrong, but from what I recall on the tour, the Little League fields are Bangor is kind of on a hill. You're downtown, you're kind of midway on the hill. You walk up the hill toward where Stephen King lives. You have to go through the tree line behind his house. You could cut through there and you're basically at where the ball fields are. Obviously we went around.
Yeah.
We didn't walk
Super
through
close.
His backyard.
Yeah. But we tried. They wouldn't let us.
But once you're up there, he paid for them to redo all the ball fields and put in an actual major league scoreboard and stuff.
Wow.
It's really awesome.
Cool.
And he didn't want his name anywhere up there, but he had his son's name on the list of players because his son was a Little League player.
Wow.
And so he refused to have, he obviously could have named it the Stephen King.
But he didn't want credit. He just wanted it to be a thing.
Yeah. But when you're up in the front, when you walk up to the front of the fields, there's the names of players and stuff. And his son's name is engraved in the ground there.
Yeah.
And that was all he wanted.
Yeah. It's pretty cute.
Yeah. Totally cool.
All right, what do you got?
Okay, what is waterless cookware? Can someone explain? Because that's the thing. At the beginning, he talks about Trisha, like Trisha will put on her, oh, waterless cookware face when she's putting, when she's like putting up with something that her family is doing and she's trying to hold her family together in pieces.
Waterless cookware?
That's, it's a thing. And it comes up a couple more times. And each time I was like, what in God's name is waterless cookware? Does anyone know?
It seems to be, I just Googled it. It seems to be copper pots and pans that
don't require water.
Waterless cooking simply means cooking without the addition of water or grease.
So like an oven?
Okay. Waterless cookware helps you prepare healthier meals while saving time, money, and energy.
A microwave?
It seems to just be a pan. I don't.
Waterless.
I guess because stainless, I guess it was the sort of thing that she's seeing on like late night.
Maybe it's, yeah, maybe it was like a fad at that time.
It must have been a fad. Waterless cookware had a big moment in the 90s.
What year does this book take place?
99.
Oh, that's when it takes place?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. I think it takes place in 98 and came out in 99.
Yeah,
the or present day. One or the other. Yeah.
That's like, that's my heyday. That's where I'm from. That's where I'm walked in time. I've never heard of waterless cookware.
But the context of it is when she's talking about like faking being excited about something in the way that like if a game show contestant had learned that they were potentially going to win some waterless cookware. So it sounds like it was something that was a popular giveaway item on game shows around the turn of the century.
I was just bewildered. I was like, never in my life have I heard.
I know.
Even feigned enthusiasm about waterless cookware.
I will say, one of the things that I loved about this book is it really did feel like a little slice of life from the late 90s.
Absolutely.
The thing that stood out to me was the Surge, which was my favorite soda when I was in middle school.
Surge. Not the Surge.
What?
You said the Surge.
The Surge in
like
the book.
Like the Purge.
Like the Surge references.
As in the
waterless cookware.
Right. Listen, the late 90s are my stomping grounds.
Okay, but I'm talking about how I loved Surge. Do you remember Surge?
I do remember Surge. Do you remember Orbitz?
The gum?
No, the drink.
No.
It had like little jelly balls in it. It was like bubble tea and soda combined.
Do you guys remember Bill Clinton?
Who's that? Anyway, Surge, for my young listeners, was this amazing drink that tasted just like Ecto Cooler, and it happened to have a ton of caffeine in it.
What is Ecto Cooler?
Ecto Cooler was the juice box that was named after
the
ghost.
Get the hell out of here.
In Ghostbusters, so it was green, and the liquid was green, and it just, I don't know what to say it tasted like, but that and Surge have the same flavor.
It was
flavor.
Like, it was citrusy.
Yeah, but it was a very specific, like I can still remember what Surge tasted like, and it's this very specific kind of citrusy.
Neon green.
I feel like Surge was just a better Mountain Dew.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
But that's what I was picturing.
Yeah. They sold it in the vending machine at my middle school and I would drink like three of them a day because I didn't realize it had caffeine in it. And it finally got discontinued clearly because it was like dangerous for children or something. But I miss it. It was so good.
I'm sorry. I love that idea that it's like, oh, this thing is poison. We have to remove
this thing off the shelves.
We gotta get this immediately.
I think that's what happened.
Wow. I wonder if it's still lurking in an old vending machine somewhere.
I look for it everywhere, honestly.
I think Mountain Dew just won the gamer market.
Yeah.
And Surge wasn't selling like it needed to.
Yeah.
Somehow Mellow Yellow is still out
also,
there.
Also, I think Surge was sort of pegged to the late 90s, like extreme, you know, branding. You know what I mean?
It was that's why it was competing in the same space as Mountain Dew. Because Mountain Dew, I was like, do you want to do a kickflip? Drink Mountain Dew.
Right, but Mountain Dew always has their just like brand of Mountain Dew to fall back on. You know, like they, like Surge, it's just like, it's like one calling note. Your soda like extreme soda. Like you're not going to drink extreme like soda.
This is the first time that it's occurring to me that in every like little chunk of years, has had its own Four Loko.
They're called generations.
I didn't want to say here's the thing. In my mind, I was like, I should say generation. And then I was like, no, as the youngest person in the room, I can't say every generation has their own bit of soda.
Well, so what's this generation's, is Four Loko of this generation or is that?
I thought it was of my cohort of our, because we're all the same generation. But
Well, depends how you count it. Eric's right on the cusp.
I'm living on the cusp.
But I thought of my particular cohort, I feel like Four Loko was the Four Loko.
Yeah. I feel like this generation is figuring out a different destructive thing to do. And that's why
it's vaping.
Yeah. Juuling is this generation's
Four Loko. What's the previous? What's before?
And Mountain Dew. And Monster Energy, I think, was our Four Loko.
Okay.
Let's bring it back to Stephen King.
Anyway,
let's
bring it back to Stephen King. Real mensch. Dumping lots of money into the local economy in Bangor. Just
a good guy.
Yeah. Really shining that place up nice.
Yeah. How about all these Stephen King movies that are coming out, huh?
Oh, God. I don't know anything about this.
Did anybody see the new Pet Sematary?
No.
No.
I have an enormous threshold for bad movies. I will watch the worst movies ever.
Okay.
I made it a third of the way into the new Pet Sematary, and I had to shut it down.
Were you watching it in the theater?
No, I was here.
Okay. That's a pretty serious indictment.
Yeah. I've watched really bad movies.
Okay, but the thing about Stephen King movies, it's like 50-50. It's very hard, I think, to translate his vision into a movie because it's like supernatural and
first Pet Sematary is thought of as being an okay movie. So that someone has already translated that vision into a film
successfully. That's true. That's not really a good excuse here.
The first one's really good.
I think the new Pet Sematary is a result of the horrible thing that's happening to every movie where they're remaking literally everything that didn't come out this year.
Yes.
Like Pet Sematary did not need a remake. People can just watch that one.
I think I completely agree with that. But also I was like, if they're going to do it, I'm going to watch it. So I watched it and they tried to make it present day creepy and not the creepy that it embodies like in the story.
Interesting.
And so like the visuals there's like in the beginning of the movie, there's the guy, I can't remember the family's name in Pet Sematary, but the dad, he's talking to the old man who's played by Fred Gwynne in the first movie, who's played by John Lithgow in the new one, I think. They're standing there talking and they were like watching kids walk to the Pet Sematary and they're all wearing like creepy masks.
Ooh.
And it's like, that's just a creepy visual that has nothing to do with the story and doesn't serve, is that his name?
Creed? Yeah.
It doesn't serve the escalating dread or tension of the story. I mean, it's just
that was people's complaint about the new It, which was an awesome movie. But It, the clown, is so much less scary now that they're doing special effects and making it look like a monster. So, whereas the old one is fucking terrifying.
Oh, my God. If you could combine the old clown with the new movie.
But so that's what I was going to say, because I think speaking generally to remakes, because I do feel this, I think a large part of it is wanting to take advantage of new special effects and everything else.
Totally.
But weirdly enough, I don't know, I was thinking about this the other night because I went to go see a play, and in the same way that the amount of work that your brain has to do to sort of provide the connective tissue between you and the reality of the play and how that can make something feel more real in its own weird way because you actually have to do that mental work.
Yep.
I feel like I felt more of that with older movies. Mm-hmm. And now, when the visuals are given easily, actually, I don't have to do the work to believe or engage in the place anymore.
It feels like fantasy. Yeah.
Totally,
yeah.
Totally.
And so it doesn't have the same effect.
Yeah. I totally agree. Completely agree.
And I also think like that's why Stephen King's books work so well, because it's like when you're reading it, sometimes I have to like read the sentence again where I'm like, oh, that was fucked up. Like, because he says it in such a subtle way where you almost don't notice it happening. Yeah. Or it's like, it's a scene that starts out like, oh, just a family sitting at home. And then you're like, oh no. Yeah. Like it feels real.
Yeah.
What did I see recently? Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Yeah.
I went to see that and I was really excited to see it because I loved that book as a kid.
Mm.
But it's a Guillermo del Toro movie. And as soon as the scary stuff started happening, I was like, oh, here I am watching a Guillermo del Toro movie where everything is like a goofy CGI monster.
Mm.
Like there's never subtlety. Like that there's nothing so crazy in that movie that it couldn't be done with like totally practical effects, no CGI.
Mm.
And there's something so like exactly what you were saying, where like when you see like an actor in the clown makeup, like your brain has to like translate. You're like,
totally. Oh,
like you.
But it's like you can imagine a guy showing up to your house wearing clown makeup.
Exactly. But also like.
Think about it, Anna.
That's the same way you had that face. You're like, think about that.
I mean, there's the reality of it, but there's also like, you do all that additional work in your brain where you're like, if he's supernatural, like this supernatural force made this incredibly realistic clown appear
and
in front of me.
That's what's scary.
So terrifying. Yeah. But when you see this thing that's like a cartoon scary clown, you're like, okay.
Yeah.
No, totally. I totally agree. I hate CGI stuff.
So here's the thing. They are turning The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon into a movie.
Oh, Jesus.
How do we feel about this?
It's going to be the most boring movie.
Well, this is something that I was thinking about as I was reading is I would love to see a film interpretation of The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon as...
Well, you're gonna.
Let me finish. As a slapstick comedy. Just like a girl who like tumbles down a ravine and like falls in a river and like...
Kristen Wiig as Tom Gordon.
Sits in her own poop accidentally.
She's walking through the woods, but she's listening to Who's On First instead of listening to it.
Oh my God, I would watch that.
But so, okay.
Yeah, she gets stung by wasps and her face looks funny afterward.
Yeah. Wow, that's hilarious. No, but I really loved, so I've hiked the portion of the AT that she gets lost off of. And I felt, I mean, obviously at moments it was like a little bit much, but I could find it really compelling if it was really stripped down.
Yeah.
Of just like the amount of fear that starts to build, that transformation of a place into becoming increasingly nefarious, you know, like the fear that builds when you are alone walking somewhere. And also there were so many great moments in this that I loved, like when I actually liked this book, when she would, every time she would be talking to herself and he would kind of come in and she would say aloud to herself, she'd be like, well, that's goofy. Or she, at some point she's like pretty goofy while she's singing to herself, which I thought was hilarious. Yeah. I felt like it switched tone really well. If there was a really good child actor, which is such a rare thing. They are out there. And if there was a really good one and it was just super stripped down, really interesting, I think.
I agree. There's not too many flashbacks. Of great horror movies about just like a person lost in the woods, and that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's scary.
And if you couple that with a really charming child actor,
it'd be great.
Well, and I also think that the concept of like one person walking through the woods as a movie has been proven as a concept by Wilde.
And The Revenant.
Yeah, pursued by her own personal demons.
Yeah. It's also
replete with flashbacks.
That's what everyone said about Gerald's Game, is that wouldn't work as a movie because do you know Gerald's Game?
No, I don't.
You saw it.
Yeah. You explained it to me when it came out.
It's very similar to this one where he sometimes does these like, clearly they're like thought exercises where he's like, how can I write a book where it's this very contained thing? Mm-hmm. And Gerald's Game is about this woman who is like on an anniversary. I have an episode about it. On an anniversary weekend with her husband, he dies in the middle of like a sex game where she's handcuffed to the bed. So she is trapped.
Oh, I know about this.
Yes. And everyone said that the movie couldn't work because they were like, in the book, it's very similar to this where it's like she's sort of hallucinating and talking to herself and trying to escape and it's very drawn out. And the movie was actually pretty good.
Yeah, totally worked.
Yeah.
I read the Wikipedia article of this. Ah. That's why I know what this is.
Like the Cliff's Notes.
I know, and I don't know why I did that, but anyway.
I would watch it. I think it might be good.
I agree.
I'd take it for a spin.
Here's another thing. This is a pop-up book too.
Wait, what?
The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon is also available as an illustrated pop-up book.
Like really? For kids or just like as a kitsch item for adults who really like the original?
I don't know. I tried to figure it out and I couldn't really, it sounds like it is the full story just illustrated and sometimes there's pop-up things, but I might just buy it just to.
It sounds like a cool thing to have, but that's not something that was like an original release, right?
I don't know when it came out, but it's apparently a lot of people first read the story from this pop-up book. So I don't know if it came out at the same time or if it's like
that's crazy.
I feel like pop-up books are like max 15 pages.
Because
the like pop-up machinery takes up so much physical space.
Maybe there's just like
enormous pop-up book.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't know how like you would compress this book to only 15 pages. I think you could compress
it. It's like you have one page where she's getting bit by mosquitoes that basically covers it.
No, yeah, I mean, there's like five pop-up parts or something in the whole thing.
But I understand that you could be like, oh, she gets lost in the woods and scary stuff happens. But to compress it and still have it mean anything seems like it would be a challenge.
Yeah,
I'm probably going to buy it. I'm intrigued. The thing that I would wonder how you would convey in a pop-up, because something I also thought was cool is like, obviously we only are actually dealing with one character for most of the parts, except for that bizarre interlude where, what was it? What was the description? An about of totally unplanned but gratifying sex.
Oh yeah, with her parents.
Yeah, with her parents. I was like, what was this? Yeah. Anyway, but.
I don't remember this at all.
Yeah, it was like a very brief, very brief interlude where, anyway, it starts out, it's like, there was nothing sexual about this. They were devastated. She was in a thin nightgown. And then it was like, actually, they had sex. It was great. Now moving back to Trisha.
Nightgown,
she was in a thin nightgown. But I completely lost my train of thought. Oh, no, even though we're only with, just thinking about the nightgown. No, but we're only with one person the entire time. But actually, I felt like you got a really clear picture of all of these other, like there was an entire cast of characters that was traveling with her in the woods, especially Pepsi.
Pepsi.
I thought Pepsi was really compelling.
If you haven't read The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, Pepsi is her best friend.
Yes.
What's Pepsi short for? Penelope or something?
Oh, it's like something really, it's...
Pepperoni?
Pepperoni. Pepsi, short for pepperoni. Pepperoni Robichaud.
Oh, Penelope maybe?
Penelope might something be like it. That, it might be it, yeah.
Who has a foul mouth and...
I don't remember.
That's all I remember. Yeah, no, you didn't read the book.
Well, she's like clearly like the friend who's maturing faster. She's sassy.
Right.
She likes boys.
Yeah.
She wants to put her face on for Halloween.
And every time Trisha swears or does anything, he's like, oh, like Pepsi would do this. Yeah. Now I'm in Pepsi's turf.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which I just thought was interesting. Like she carries this, even obviously she imagines Tom Gordon is there with her and she has this sort of like guardian angel who's walking with her. But she also, I don't know, I thought that was one of the transformations of it that happens to her in the book, as she starts out where most of her language is parroted from other people in her life. It's either her family or Tom Gordon or Pepsi. And then it gradually shifts to, she gets to the point where she's like making her own language and catchphrases and her own statements.
It's a coming of age story.
Yes, it's true. Buildings Ramon.
I wonder if I would like this book more if I had read it later in life. Like, I'm not sure that when I read it, I was like 19 maybe.
I think you're one of those people, and I was saying you were looking for a Stephen King book. You weren't like.
Yeah. I wonder if like, cause I didn't pick up on any of that obviously when I read it, and I wonder if I was more in tune with what was going on in the book, if I would have enjoyed it more.
I read this book when I was 12 for a book report in seventh grade.
Yeah.
Mm. And then read it again this week to prepare to be on this podcast. Jumping back to the when to read this book, like in your life question. It was interesting reading this as an adult, but also like reflecting on how I related to it as a 12-year-old reading it, because, you know, you read that and you're like, oh, like this is a kid and I am a kid and these are the decisions that I would make if I was in this situation because we are the same level of maturity and intelligence. And, as a 30-year-old looking back on this and reading, is be like, a kid's doing all this?
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Yeah.
I do. I feel like I have that relationship with a lot of Stephen King books because I read a lot of his classic stuff when I was younger, like Carrie and Cujo and all that stuff. And at the time, it's like, I think I sort of like skimmed every book like it was a book for school. You know, like I remember reading that book. Is it Hatchet that everybody reads in middle school?
Yes, it is Hatchet.
And like, at some point later in life, I looked up what the plot is and I remember being like, that is so upsetting. Yeah. When you're reading it for school, you're like, ah, whatever, this kid's in the, I don't remember what he does with the hatchet. I don't know what happens. But I feel that way about a lot of Stephen King books where like when I read-
What the hell is Hatchet?
You've never read Hatchet by Gary Paulson?
It's like a classic.
I don't think so.
It's like the book about a kid being self-sufficient.
I mean, I read My Side of the Mountain.
It's basically the same thing. It's a little bit more gristly because My Side of the Mountain is the kid's like, screw you parents, I'm out of here. I'm going to live on the mountain. And then Hatchet is a kid's like in a plane crash and doesn't have a choice.
That's what it is.
Right.
He like survives with his hatchet.
And all he has is a hatchet.
And he's like, I'm gonna take this hatchet and I'm gonna build a mansion out here in the woods.
Yeah, that sounds
and a hydroelectric generator, and I'm gonna live like a king.
Yo, that sounds awesome.
Which would no longer be possible with today's TSA regulations.
Also, children don't know how to use tools anymore because they're just on their phones all the time.
Mm. I'm not gonna read it, so can you spoil it for me? Does he make the hydroelectric generator?
I think he does.
No,
well.
I was really embellishing it. He constructs a crude shelter and like
a trap for animals.
He makes it out. And it's all because of his self-sufficiency and ability to rely on his like survival
and
abilities.
And his hatchet.
Because he has a hatchet.
When I read My Side of the Mountain, in the book there were these like hand-drawn diagrams for how to make fish hooks.
Wow.
And when I was a little kid, I would go out in my front yard and I would cut twigs off the shrubs and I would tie little like handmade fish hooks.
That's cool.
Using the little diagrams. Cause I was like, yeah, when I get out there in the woods, I'm going to be able to get a fish.
That's good.
I, this brings me to a question for the king heads present.
Do you mean singular?
Eric, do you not qualify? I feel like
depends.
I mean,
the
compared
question
to Maya, I'm
okay,
not, but,
okay. You talk about Hatchet and My Side of the Mountain, and like through the course of those books, you're positive that the kid is going to make it out okay. Like that's just how the story has to happen. And this is a Stephen King book, but it's about a 9-year-old girl, you know, lost in the woods. Are there any Stephen King books that like set a precedent that she might not make it out?
So there's definitely a lot of Stephen King books where a main character dies, and there are some, like I can think of some short stories where the protagonist dies or ends up in a really bad situation. There's definitely books where kids die, but there was never a point in this book where I thought that Trisha would not make it out of the woods.
Can you think of what would be, not to put you on the spot, but what would be a Stephen King story where the protagonist dies?
I'm thinking of like, there's that short story, for example, with a couple on the plane. There's a bunch of like novellas and short stories where people are like trapped in a loop or like, I don't know, there's stuff like that. I can't really think of any full books.
Right.
I'll keep thinking about it. Like the main character. What about, Dolores Claiborne? Doesn't she die?
I don't know. I haven't read that.
She definitely ends up in a bad situation, but I think she survives. I think she's in jail at the end.
Yeah. I can't think
of. Sorry, spoiler alert.
In the jail room at the club.
Sorry. Call back. I'll look it up.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, just because thinking like it's a more compelling story if you're not sure whether or not she's going to make it out.
Yeah.
But it would be pretty brutal for Stephen King to write a story where a girl gets lost in the woods for 300 pages and then just
dies.
Starves to death.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wasn't sure if she was going to make it out. Honestly, what I thought was going to happen was she would get to the hospital and then die. Or, you know, there would be something like, and which it could be, the ending is sort of ambiguous. I mean, it is clear she survives, which is great. But there is that, you know, the last thing that we get of her is she made the save. She closed her eyes. In some ways, her narrative arc is done. And it could be, I don't know.
No, you think she's dead at the end?
No, I don't think she's dead, but I think there is the possibility. Well, honestly, what I was wondering is if she ever pops up in another King book as even like a background character. So. What a shame. It would be interesting.
Carrie dies at the end, but she's not the protagonist.
Carrie's not the protagonist?
She's not?
Wow, that's total news to me. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Was it Carrie's mom?
I mean, Carrie's mom is definitely... have you guys seen her, Red Carrie?
No.
I've seen the movie.
I know the premise.
Carrie's the protagonist though, right?
It's complicated. I mean, Carrie murders all of her classmates for making fun of her. It's not really her fault because her mom like messed her up.
Right.
But I don't remember, I think this happens in the book too, but in the movie it's like she comes back as this like monster.
But she's the central character.
Yeah, but a protagonist, doesn't that imply that they're the good character?
No. Oh, I see. I see what you're saying.
I don't think
that
so.
She's not the hero.
Yeah. The protagonist is just the one who is like reacting to, like the protagonist is the one who's on the journey and reacting to the kind of like anti.
So yeah, so there's one.
Yeah, you can have an eagle.
It's just that you don't really
protagonist.
Feel bad when Carrie dies.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm trying to think of one. Oh, what about Dead Zone? Doesn't the
main
guy...
I don't remember
guy...
what happens at the end of Dead Zone. What's Dead Zone about? Dead Zone's
it's
the one
that
where
Christopher Walken movie.
Yeah, but didn't we read the book?
Yeah.
And he...
It's the one where he gets...
like, he dies and comes back and has the
Yeah, but
ability.
Then I think there's like a tragic... Oh, I'm going to look it up and find you some tragic endings.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Did people like Trisha?
I really liked Trisha.
I liked her too.
Yeah. I found her very relatable.
She had spunk.
Yeah, she did.
She did. Oh my God. I'm sorry. I did. I thought that moment again, another moment I wrote down when she was like lost and sitting in my own crap.
I know.
And then like, starts laughing. I thought that was so cute.
Yeah.
Terrible episode. But.
We didn't find out, and I thought this was interesting. We know nothing about what she looks like. Mm. At what it's like halfway through the book, they mention that she has white skin, and like 50 pages later, you hear that she has blonde hair.
Yes.
But that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I thought, you know. Cool. It's true.
Yeah.
I guess that sort of makes sense because she's by herself the entire time, right?
Right. She can't look in a mirror or anything.
Yeah. But also like the...
Yeah. Bear's not going to wander by and be like, nice green eyes.
But even as you're like, if you're writing it, you're like, it doesn't have to be like literally someone looking in a mirror, but like someone's appearance matters as it relates to people around them. And if she's in the woods by herself, like...
I'm trying to think, do you feel like Stephen King usually like describes physical appearances? Because I feel like there's often been times where I'm surprised when the movie adaptation comes out and I'm like, that's totally not what I was picturing.
Mm.
Though I wouldn't expect a movie adaptation to be like a translation of what's
no, but it's more
page.
Like, you know, when there is a book where they explain what someone looks like, so then when you see the movie and they look different, you're like, oh, okay, they went a different direction. But I feel like often when I see Stephen King movies, I'm just like, oh, I had like no real picture in my head of like,
yeah,
doesn't really solidify.
I can't think of a Stephen King story where I had a super clear picture.
Yeah.
Of-
Mm. That wasn't like a movie that you got it from.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anna, when we were reading the book, because we read it at the same time, we were talking a lot about all the very visceral explanations of what it's like to be lost in the woods. I thought that was the strongest part of this book because I would have had a hard, like when I started reading it, I was like, oh boy, this is going to be really boring. It's just a girl alone in the woods. And it was pretty upsetting and riveting.
Yeah, I agree. Again, like everything was nefarious. The way that he would sort of describe the intentions of the mosquitoes.
Yeah, I thought the mosquitoes were the worst part.
Awful. And they are. They will like drive you to madness. That was the most, like I think the closest, when I think about the closest experiences I've had to like going mad, it's like when you're being pursued, sort of this relentless pursuit by mosquitoes. So that was good. But I also, I liked the moments where she was actually happy in the woods. There were a lot
where
of those
just, like,
really...
she like set her jaw and decided to have a, like to just deal with it.
And also that, but she would actually be like, she would have moments of euphoria.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where she's like, I can't ever repeat this to people outside because they'll never understand.
Yeah.
Like when she sees the butterflies across the way that then turn into the creepy demons.
Yeah.
Or when... the wasp priest, or then when like, I think when she first finds the bed of needles in between the two rocks, there were just like a lot of moments where she's actually really overcome by how beautiful everything is, which I thought was kind of cool, which felt like Stephen King talking through that. Where he's like, wow, the world.
Do you guys think, so all the, like the wasp priest and the god of the lost and all the heads and all that stuff, do you think any of that was real? Like, what do you think was happening?
No.
You think none of it was real?
I think that... well, because when the, like, she met the wasp priests, that was when she, like, shortly thereafter she woke up and she's like, oh, that was all just a dream.
Maybe. Right?
No.
And, or is that a different part of the book?
I think initially, because she has the dream. Oh, well, I think it's unclear. She's unclear whether she's fallen asleep or she's actually seeing this when she's awake. Right. Because then she will reflectively dream about it. But I think that when it was happening, she's like, is, I mean, she could be asleep. She could not be. I guess, yeah.
And at the end, I thought it was pretty clear that, like, she was just hallucinating that that bear was full of wasps and really it was just a bear.
So I felt that way because I was pretty sure it was going to be a bear from the start, because claw marks and all this stuff. I was like, oh, it's a bear. That makes sense.
It did not occur to me a single time that it might be a bear, really.
I was like, oh, it's,
I was like, what could
being,
that be?
She's being pursued by a bear. And then at the end was, actually the ending was the first time where I was like, ooh, I think that maybe, because I was like, oh, it's all in her head. It's a bear. That's the whole story. And then at the end, I was like, oh, actually, I think there is some weird supernatural thing that is inhabiting the bear. That's my feeling.
What makes you think it is a supernatural thing?
Well, I mean, there's the one throwaway line where the guy who is the town drunk, so no one would believe him, says he didn't feel it was a bear. He would never tell that to anyone. Mm-hmm. They would never believe him. So there's that kind of like throwaway third party perspective. But I also just, I don't know. I think because it's something about it, it just feels like there actually might be a supernatural. It's not so much because I think like there is one god of the lost who is,
but it's like
who's hanging around. But I think it's more that like the woods have the potential to manifest a supernatural energy that embodies things then, or like takes over their bodies.
Yeah. I will also say a very common Stephen King theme is like kids who can pick up on supernatural things. It's called The Shining when adults can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that he was implying that Trisha had The Shining necessarily, but he does often talk about how kids are more attuned to that stuff than adults are.
I also think that like he's creating this like window of eeriness, right? Because like if you think about what's the story about, it's this single individual walking through the woods and like the woods, if you're walking through the woods by yourself and there's nothing going on, like there's like a void of meaning. And if you're lost, like you're, if you start losing your mind, like your brain is going to start trying to make sense of things.
Totally.
And so like you can imagine like you have this unreliable narrator that's like, like grasping to create meaning out of this like utterly meaningless landscape that they're walking through.
Totally.
And then like a perfect thing, like a perfect device to make that incredibly eerie is to have, you know, some tangential character to be like, maybe that thing is real.
Yeah.
You know, like it's like such a perfect device to like create that moment of like, is it real? Is it not? And you have no way of knowing as a reader, but like it could be.
Well, that's like in Gerald's Game. Remember the space cowboy?
What?
Can I spoil Gerald's Game for
Please.
You?
Please. I told you I read the Wikipedia article.
I don't remember the space.
So one of the things that she hallucinates in, this is just a great example of how Stephen King does this, and you never know if he's talking about something real or not. One of the things that she hallucinates is this creepy guy standing in the corner and staring at her, and he's like huge and never says anything, and he's kind of, I'm getting chills thinking about it. Like imagine you're stuck there, tied to a bed in the dark, and she's there for multiple days, so like it gets dark, and when it gets dark, it's like she sort of wakes up and sees this scary guy there.
Oh my God.
She starts calling him the space cowboy, and you're like, okay, whatever, she's hallucinating a bunch of things. And at the end, it turns out that there was an escaped murderer who was standing in the corner of her room and was hiding in the house the whole time she was trapped there. And you know that because at the end, the book finishes with these news clippings about this escaped murderer who she then has to like go to his trial and like point him out and be like, yeah, that's the fucking guy who was staring at me while I was trapped there.
Oh my God.
That
so
is
scary.
Awesome.
I could faint.
Yeah. But also-
I know, terrifying.
Also a great, a great device. Like, and you yourself are set up to doubt them.
Totally.
And then you're fed reasons not to doubt them, but you're so primed to doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and then suddenly you're ripped back to, you know, what reality is. That's like such a good device, such a great way to tell a story. I don't know how you figure out how to do that, but
he says the story has just come to him.
Yeah. I mean, Yeah. I mean, people are gifted.
But Stephen King is gifted.
But that's part of why it made me feel better that they didn't kill the bear at the end.
Yeah.
Bear just gets clipped.
Just shot him in the ear.
Because you're like, yeah, it might just be a bear.
Yeah, because I actually think it was just a bear. Well, because also like
you just said you thought it wasn't just a bear.
No.
I thought it got possessed temporarily.
Exactly. Okay, yeah. That's what I think.
I see that.
I think the God of the Lost is a separate thing that possessed the bear.
It's like in the Great Outdoors when the bear gets shot in the ass and it only just skins his butt and he gets to run away.
Can I say something else? I just realized it's maybe kind of a dumb realization.
As long as we can go back to the Great Outdoors afterward.
Sure. Again, it's a Stephen King podcast, but if we must, we can. I didn't really think about why it's called the God of the Lost, but if you like, maybe everyone else noticed this, but it's like he was following her while she was lost. And then at the moment when she got found by a person, he went away and then it was just a bear.
I didn't think about that. Yeah. That's interesting. That's fascinating. Yeah. Or she also found herself.
That could have been her
when
own,
she's having the pitch. Yeah.
Her
totally.
Like,
yeah.
Her
yeah.
own logic.
Her just interpretation like, yeah, of like, yeah, oh, yeah, I don't need the God of the Lost anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also because no bear is out here pursuing a human for miles.
Maybe he's hungry.
Yeah, that's not how bears do it.
It's not how bears do it.
No.
No.
It could have been like six different bears, though.
Six different
that's
bears.
True. It could just could be that there's
bears
in the woods.
A series of bears tag teaming.
But also like the one leg of the... So funny. And at every different checkpoint, one bear says to the other one's like, so this day she did this and like she seems to be moving in this trajectory.
You take it from here.
Yeah, exactly. But no... Even just like that dramatic description of like the one deer leg and the deer head and all that stuff. It just felt so, that's why it made me feel like that's not a bear. It's a possessed bear.
Yeah. I like that explanation. I think that makes sense.
Speaking of gods of the lost and gods and God in general.
Uh-huh. Go on.
There were a fair amount of religious overtones to this book, I feel like.
Yeah.
The whole like Tom Gordon pointing at the sky when he gets a save and then talking about how God shows up in the bottom of the ninth.
Yeah.
Is that a common Stephen King motif?
So there's a lot of books where he talks about religion and people struggling with religion. I don't think that Stephen King, my impression is, I don't know if you have a different thought, but so his daughter is a minister or something. So there's definitely like some religion in his family, but from his tweets, I don't find him to be a particularly religious person, but I think he uses it more as a mechanic to describe people who are struggling or addicted or growing up. Like I think in this case, it was a way to do her coming of age story, which like she needed this thing to attach herself to. And it's like she turned her very physical challenge into this kind of like metaphysical religious question that like helped her through it.
Oh, totally. I loved the idea of the subaudible.
Yeah.
I thought that was so, have people... Is that a thing that people have encountered before?
I don't know what you're talking about because I read this book 20 years ago.
Exactly. So
we all have to stop looking at Eric.
Basically, Trisha's dad, when she asks, she sort of asks some questions about God. And Trisha's dad's response is that he doesn't believe in God per se, but he believes in the subaudible, which what is the exact example he uses? I don't remember, but he's like explaining it's the things that are happening that are unseen and unheard, but we can recognize as existing.
The example that he gives is the force that keeps drunk teenagers heading home from prom from crashing.
Yes.
Which left a impression on me when I read it when I was 12 and forgot about until I was like a paragraph before in this read through being like, oh, like I thought about that a lot that year. And like,
oh, fascinating. What about that struck you?
Just because it's the nature of any 12-year-old to be like, has everything I've been told a lie? Like, is there no what are the supernatural forces going on like compared to just the God that I've been told lives everywhere and not to question? And maybe there is something between the hardline Bible God that I've been taught about and nothing.
Yeah.
And maybe it's the subaudible.
Yeah. I loved that idea. And it makes sense to me. God in the Stephen King universe makes sense to me because he's already dealing with so many forces that are beyond explanation. I say this, I literally know nothing about Stephen King, actually, in my infinite expertise about Stephen King.
In the universe of this book.
Yeah, exactly. Right? It makes sense because obviously there are so many things that just require belief. And so why not? You know, that is sort of the ultimate one that we can already root in. And then you have to find the other ones.
I do have an answer, which is he was raised Methodist, but lost his belief in organized religion while in high school, but he still chooses to believe in the existence of God.
Interesting.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So
cool.
You hiked the Appalachian Trail.
Not the entire trail, but I've hiked at this point about 150 miles on it.
Wow.
yeah, because mostly, so I led backpacking trips in college and then out of college. And so, this portion, I led a bunch of this, like crossing the border of New Hampshire into Maine and then doing the Mahoosuc Notch and all of that, led some 12 to 14 year olds, which is also funny. Cause like, obviously thinking about these,
yeah,
like she was younger, but yeah, thinking about, my kids. And then I've done the Northern Terminus, the 100-mile wilderness, and then Katahdin. And then I've done a portion in, actually not too far from here, but in the Delaware River water gap in New Jersey and Pennsylvania.
I am familiar with the water gap.
Yeah. So I did some hiking there too on the AT.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it was pretty fun.
All right, guys, you ready to talk about connections?
Yeah, we're back.
I've been waiting all night for this.
It's the best part. You know, this is called the Dairy Connection.
Is it?
Get it?
Well, no, because I don't know enough about Stephen King to relate that back to why it's such a clever reference.
Well, Derry is a town.
Mm.
Anyway, Anna, do you want to start?
You're not going to explain what the Derry Connection means?
Oh, why? Didn't I? Derry is a town that Stephen King made up, and a lot of stories are connected, and a lot of them are connected to Derry. And this is where I talk about connections, and some of them are related to Derry.
But also, it's because of the donut connection.
Oh, right.
Can someone explain what the donut connection is?
It's just a donut place in Pennsylvania.
I think we were looking for names that were about connections, and Eric was like, maybe the donut connection.
No, you came up with it.
It's a very clever name for the podcast. That's what important here. What are all of the Derry connections in The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, then?
There it is. Anna, even though this was your first Stephen King book, you found a connection in there.
Yes, I did. A mention of Castle Rock.
What's Castle Rock?
It was a neighboring town in the book. I just knew that it was a thing because I did a deep dive of Maya's blog beforehand.
The Dairy Connection. No, dairyconnection.com. I don't remember what my URL
is. I think it is dairyconnection.com.
Yeah.
Do you know, Maya, every time I try to demo something, I'll try to pull up your podcast and every freaking time I get the vanity wrong. And so it'll be like,
because it has the dash in there.
Oh my God. And so every time I'm displaying it for people, I'm like, well, as you can see on this podcast, and then I go, and it's like a 404 page and it's like, what on what podcast? Anyway. Yeah. And so I knew that Castle Rock was a thing because I'd seen it mentioned.
That's a good one. And that's the perfect kind of Stephen King connection where it's subtle. It's not super in your face. It's just like a cute little like, ooh, it's in the same universe.
Oh, because it's where the radio broadcast is coming from. Yes.
There we go. Castle Rock is another made up city that Stephen King talks about a lot. But fun fact, Stephen King has his own radio station in Bangor where he plays, what is it, like
Castle Rock and Roll?
It has a classic rock station.
Yeah.
KBUR? Classic Castle Rock.
I can't remember. Didn't you get like a tote bag or something from
there?
No,
it's on my wish list and you haven't bought it for me.
Oh, you mean we got stickers or something?
Yeah. I think we took a tour of the radio station.
Yeah.
That's a great one.
What? Didn't he DJ on it for a while?
I think so. When it first started, I think he was like actively on the air and now it's just running.
Yeah, but now he just owns it.
Pretty cool.
Wow.
Yeah. So Castle Rock's a good one. So there weren't a lot of connections in this book, I think, because it wasn't super about that. But I have two other ones. Duncan, did you find any?
I think so.
Okay.
So after she drinks the tainted river water and almost poops her pants, but poops on the ground and then slips in it and like is sitting in her own poop.
You have a connection or you just wanted to say that?
She
a little of both.
Stands up and Stephen King wrote The Stand.
Whoa.
And then she uses her backpack to carry stuff.
Whoa.
Oh, and
I did not find any connections. I don't know enough about Stephen King. Yeah.
That was good, Duncan.
That's very generous of you.
Andy Dufresne swam through a river of poop.
True.
To get to freedom.
Mm.
That's less of a connection, more of a theme.
What other Stephen King books do they deal with feces?
Probably somewhere in It because they're in the sewer.
Ooh, there's some duty
probably.
In It.
There's also, I mean, Dreamcatcher has a really...
Oh yeah, the shit weasel, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
Weasel?
Yeah, I only know about Dreamcatcher.
Dreamcatcher was not his best.
But the reason people know about Dreamcatcher is because the first trailer for The Matrix Reloaded aired before Dreamcatcher. So there were a bunch of people who would go and either leave immediately because they had no interest in seeing Dreamcatcher halfway through because apparently it was a really bad movie.
That was, for my younger listeners, that was back in the day before YouTube, so you couldn't just look up a trailer whenever you wanted to watch it.
Yeah.
It was terrible back then.
Wait, could someone, I'm sorry, the shit weasel. Could
if you
explain?
Had to guess what the shit weasel is, what would you say?
I'm picturing a weasel covered in shit.
No.
And keep in mind, this is in a book called Dreamcatcher, if that helps.
Called the Dream... So
I don't know how that helps.
It's... No, I have no idea. So it's like, what is it?
I mean, think about it. Shit weasel.
Think about
dream
it.
Dreamcatcher. Do the math.
Yeah, if you free associate on this, you'll probably get pretty close.
What is happening? Are they high? What is the...
I'm sorry. Pardon my French. We have to believe that out. What is the shit weasel?
First of all,
here's what I want to know: is when you say shit weasel, are you saying it in as shorthand to reference something that's not actually called the shit weasel?
Is it
like capital S, capital W, shit weasel in the book?
I don't think so.
I have no idea.
I don't know about the book. In the film's Wikipedia page, it is referred to as the shit weasel.
So I guess. I don't remember the movie.
I can't say.
I will say the book was not as ridiculous, but I just looked up the Wikipedia, like the plot summary for the book, and I think this sort of paints the picture. There, a guy gets abducted by aliens. The friends are like in a cabin or something somewhere, so they're remote somewhere, and he gets sicker over time and then dies while sitting on the toilet.
Oh, I remember that scene in the movie.
And then we meet.
Yeah. In the book, an extraterrestrial parasite eats its way out of his body, presumably into the toilet. And then you can imagine how this got translated in the movie, where then this thing has to come back and eat all the other people.
And so... I'm sorry. So I guess, so the parasite, but it's called, do the people in the movie refer to it as a shit weasel?
Yeah, I think there's
like it's the shit weasel.
Yeah, when they see it come out of the toilet, out of the guy's like corpse.
That does sound like
what is that? Shit weasel.
It's a shit weasel.
That sounds like he's
I also, if memory serves, it looks nothing like an actual earth weasel.
Whoa.
I don't know where the term weasel came from because it's very much like lamprey-esque.
I just remember going to see the movie.
Oh my God, I just clenched thinking about a lamprey. Like oh, it's horrible.
And
oh,
I think it is actually called a shit weasel because I Googled shit weasel and it came up.
Honestly, you could have done a lot worse.
That's true.
Can I see what it looks like? I just want to make sure that my lamprey-esque description is accurate.
Oh, horrible. Yeah.
It's like a worm with teeth.
Oh, yeah.
Can you see it?
Yeah, I'd call that a shit weasel.
I just remember I don't remember everything about the movie, but I remember it being so over the top and I was like just so many more... it was so focused on that, whereas in the book, I felt like it was just a tiny... Because at the end of it's actually an alien. It's just that it happens to come out of the toilet.
Isn't it Jason Lee who's...
Jason Lee's the shit weasel?
No, I think he's the one who
I think he is.
He's like a great actor.
He's the one who shits first. And
he's the one who dies?
Yeah.
Wait, this shit weasel comes out of everyone's bottom? Like, that's how it...
I love that shit weasel a bunch of times.
I remember.
I'm just imagining like John Carpenter's The Thing, but instead of like it can get you anyway, it has to like incubate in you and come out your butt.
I think it's just a coincidence that in one scene it ends up in the toilet.
I remember going to see this in the theater and I was so psyched because it was a Stephen King movie. And at the time I was a huge fan of Jason Lee and I was like, oh man, Jason Lee's in a Stephen King movie. This is the best of both worlds.
The one that dies on the toilet.
Yeah. And I was like, everybody just starts shitting black goo. And I was like, what the fuck is this?
Do you know who else is in that movie?
Who?
Timothy Oliphant.
Oh my God.
We got to watch it again. I'm a big Timothy Oliphant fan.
I think you've told me
this. I hope for realism's sake, before you watch it, you will watch the trailer for The Matrix Reloaded really put yourself back in that time. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I'm in.
That would have been like,
it makes sense to me.
What, 2002?
That sounds about right. 2001, 2000.
Yeah, I remember seeing it with my cousin who visited for my eighth grade graduation. Okay. Yeah.
Is it the first Matrix sequel?
Yeah.
Why are we talking about Dreamcatcher? How did we get here?
I don't know. But
poop.
It makes so much sense.
Themes of poop and Steve
Weasel.
Yeah. The duty connection.
That's your podcast.
You're right. You're right about that. Eric, you want to be on the duty connection?
Hell yeah, I do.
Okay, so back to other themes in Stephen King books. One that I always find hilarious. So the worst Stephen King series that I've ever read was Mr. Mercedes. Did you read any of those?
No.
It's called that because there's a murderer who like runs people over in a Mercedes and they don't know who he is. So he's whatever.
Spooky.
But the actual series is about this retired detective.
Sorry,
whatever. But it's about this retired detective who's like trying to track down all these semi-supernatural murderers. And Stephen King, I think because he's like 85 years old, does not know how computers work. Like he still types on a typewriter.
Oh, I read the cell phone one.
Oh, that one was also That one was less bad because at least it came out when cell phones were new. So you could like forgive him. But this is Mr. Mercedes is his newest series. It came out like a few years ago. And I wish I had some examples, but it's like Stephen King is like,
I typed in the Google and it's like, it just sounds like an old person trying to describe, but like very unironically. And I just noticed that even back in the day, in the late 90s, when he wrote this, he refers to Pete as like bullied in school and his nickname is Pete's CompuWorld.
Oh, I know.
Who would say that?
Yeah,
I know that was a store.
It's so
true. But what
true.
Kind of bullying insult is that? And it just reminded me of his weird like relationship with computers where he has no sense of what anybody ever says.
Well, there, first of all, that's incredible because it means he's been out of touch with like everyone for 20 years.
Yeah.
But also that, like there's, consistent. There are a few points in this book where he clearly like takes a thing that actually exists and like changes it a little bit to be a fictional version of that thing. Like CompuWorld to like that. I think he's thinking of CompUSA.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not actually called CompuWorld?
No.
I
CompUSA.
See.
But in the same sense that like her favorite band is Boys to the Max.
Yeah.
Oh, that I know. Pretty silly. Oh, wasn't it extreme? Yeah. Didn't have two X's or something. It was really horrible.
Boys to the Max with two X's.
Garbage.
It's clearly Boys to Men.
Yes.
Complete with misspelling or exchange of number for
word.
My
God. Mortifying.
But yeah, I think I agree with you, Maya, that it's pretty cringy. The like he needed to make up a thing that kids would call this kid because
it's
he's
just
a nerd.
So silly.
But yeah, it's really obtuse.
Also, if you're gonna make fun of someone, you wouldn't be like, "Hey, Pete's CompuWorld." Imagine saying that insult to somebody.
Yeah. I don't know.
Call him CompuWorld.
I see what you're saying, but if I was trying to like make fun of a nerd, and I was like, "Hey, Best Buy, what's up?" That's kind of
right.
Hurtful.
But would you say, "Hey, Eric's Best Buy, what's up?"
Yeah, that's true.
Best Buy.
Exactly. All right.
Very confusing.
I do have one real connection.
Oh, okay.
I'm about to blow your minds.
All right.
Wait, before that, can we do the baby connection? Just small theme that we just brought up, which is that Trisha's dad has a drinking problem. And you said that's a common.
Super common theme.
Super common theme.
I don't know if you know this. Stephen King struggled with a lot of addictions. Alcohol was one. Coke was one. So that is a super common theme, is like people overcoming addiction. And there are a lot of alcoholic writers specifically in his books.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, cool. Now blow our minds.
Okay. So the Dark Tower, which Duncan knows half of, do you remember where the Dark Tower is? Like, did you get into any of that lore before you gave up?
I mean, I think the answer to your question is going to be no. It's in Midworld. I know that's not what you're looking for because that's very
basic. Do you remember the
beams? I remember it's emanating beams.
The beans?
The Dark Tower is actually on a soybean plantation in Iowa.
Okay, so the Dark Tower, some of this I'm sure will come back to you. So the Dark Tower is, we talk about the Stephen King universe, but there's actually a Stephen King multiverse.
Ooh.
And the idea is, it's really hard to explain, and I'm probably not going to do it justice, but basically there is this dark tower that sort of sits in the middle of the whole universe. And there are, I think, 12 beams that come off out of the tower, making this sort of circle. And all of the different possible universes, because in the Dark Tower, there's multiple universes. Do you remember that part?
Yes.
They're all sort of like layered on the beams, and the beams are what hold up the multiverse. This is sort of, I don't know how to translate this, but like there are 12 guardians of the beam, and each one is an animal. And so, the book you gave up on, the fifth book, I hope you don't mind if I spoil one reveal in that book. Do you mind?
No, not at all.
So it turns out they're sort of like alluding to these guardians of the beam, and you're like, you don't know if it's a metaphor or if they're literal animals or what's going on. And it turns out that they're all cyborg animals that were created by, do you remember that?
Well, because there is a scene that I did read where they meet like the big turtle.
Yes.
And they, I don't know if they like have to fight him or run from him, but it's like clearly a cyborg guardian related to the Dark
Tower. And do you remember that turtle is also an it?
I'm sure I would if I had read it.
I do remember that turtle.
So there's like, I don't remember who the spider represents, but that's sort of like the root of, I think the spider is a representation of the Crimson King, which is the guy who sits on top of the Dark Tower.
Well, they talk about like there's that fable or something of the whole world, like being on the back of a turtle.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
So there are these 12 guardians of the beam. So the bear, one of them is a bear. I just sort of gave it away. One of them is a bear called Shardik. And the description of Shardik is, a cyborg bear that stands over 40 feet tall and has a contraption affixed to its head resembling a satellite dish that looks like a little cap.
This is sounding familiar.
Yes. And the other thing that might sound familiar is that when the guy shoots the bear, Trisha sees a couple batteries fall out of the bear's head.
Oh my God.
What?
Wow. Well, it's her Walkman, right? But
Or is it?
Oh my gosh.
Ah!
Hold on. So
When was The Dark Tower written?
He started it in the 70s, I think. It's his magnum opus. So he was working on it for like 40 years.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
so
it's like one book every 7 years.
Yeah.
So you're telling me that this story that we were reading, maybe, thinking it was in this world,
maybe,
which it is in this world, but that
it's
this
all
world
in the same multiverse
might be a part of that multiverse,
yeah,
with this guardian. And we just were in the beam guarded by Shardik.
Shardik.
Mm, no. So the other thing is Shardik was he's described as he's a lost guardian or something. Oh yeah. He's a lost guardian, meaning like he wandered away from holding up the beam. So part of what's happening in the Dark Tower is the problem is the multiverse is crumbling because various guardians are wandering away or getting their little cyborg things get messed up and they turn evil or they get killed.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And Shardik, I don't remember what the story is, but when they meet the bear in the Dark Tower, I think you saw that. I think that's in maybe the third one when they
first
see the bear.
Him shooting the bear and batteries falling out. I've definitely read that.
Yeah. So like, but I think when they get that contraption off him, either it kills him or he goes back to normal. Like it's clear that somebody was like messing with the bear.
Oh my God.
Isn't that
creepy
crazy?
Chills. Yeah.
I know.
Weird. Cool.
The dairy connection.
Experienced it firsthand. Wait, can I share one more line from the book that I liked?
Please.
I love when Trisha, when she first finds the path that she's walking on with the different, you know, where she like, basically she's been wandering for forever. She's been out there for weeks. She has pneumonia. She gets to that
old
path.
Thing, yeah.
Exactly. And she sees a truck. But the way that it's described is she sees something from the world of people, a thing with corners. I loved that line.
Yeah.
I thought that was so smart. It's so true.
Yeah.
You know, because something has a distinct cornered shape.
I love that.
That's us. We shape things
into
corners. Sorry, what a lame. I know. Yeah. But still, I was still really struck by it.
Cubes. One shape.
It all comes back to Klube.
All right. Final thoughts. Duncan.
Thank you for giving me an opportunity to read a book that I read when I was 12 and reflect on not only the work itself, but who I was when I read it then.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for getting me excited about Tom Gordon years ago.
Thank you for inviting
me. They don't all have to be thank yous. Just final thoughts.
Oh, I thought we were going to all thank you.
This is the part of the show where you all thank me. Yeah.
Yeah. My final thoughts. After this show, I realize I don't remember much about the book.
You told me you were going to read the Wikipedia page before this. Did you not do that either?
No.
Okay. That might have helped.
You sort of encouraged me not to. So.
Well, I said people have come in blind before. It's okay if you want to do that. But.
This has been fascinating, and I'm happy that I've been able to increase the audio quality of your show for an episode.
It's sort of like you heard the audiobook. You've been listening to us describe the feeling of the
I would movie. Be very curious for Eric to write a summary of what happens in the group.
Ooh, that's a great idea. And then before you look at Wikipedia, and then we'll compare it.
Yeah, I mean, a girl gets lost in
the
woods.
Write it.
There's a bear with batteries in his head, and then she shits herself. And
that is sort of the
pretty
key
close,
details.
Yeah.
not the worst synopsis.
So I got it.
Okay, Anna, final thoughts.
Final thoughts. Well, one, I am sad. I realize we didn't talk about the Tough Tootsie, but I guess not
well,
that
this
important.
Is your chance.
This is my chance to talk about, but I'm not sure if I want to waste my final thoughts on the Tough Tootsie. I thought initially I came in thinking she was clearly an evil internal voice, but actually she's kind of trying to keep Trisha safe. There's a weird little different relationship that she develops with that internal voice. I know. I would recommend this book to young readers. I liked it. Like, I'm not going to go, again, I don't feel like it's my new favorite novel, but yeah, after reading it, I've tried rewriting a short story that I've been working on in this sort of style and like had some fun with that. And that
Ooh.
Was cool. And it just like, it was a really, I enjoyed it actually.
Do you think you're going to read more Stephen King books?
I totally do actually now, especially after this, I'm so curious. Cause of course I've had this idea of what Stephen King books are based on
this
understanding.
Pretty,
and obviously
pretty
that's
the
completely
norm,
incorrect.
Say.
Yeah. Talk to us in a year and a half when you finish The Stand.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't start reading The Stand. It's not a good starting point.
Why?
Because you wanna get into it.
I disagree. I think it's a great read.
What should I read second?
You want like a typical Stephen King book?
Sure. I know I'm gonna read The Stand.
What kind of feeling do you want to have?
I know I'm gonna read The Stand. So give me a typical Stephen King.
How do you
book.
Feel about poop?
How do I feel about poop? How do I feel about shit weasels?
It's
really
because if you're looking for shit weasels, do you have specific. The book for you?
And really, what I'm looking for
I have
is to be terrified every time I sit down on the toilet. No, but I
have you seen it, the first half of it?
No.
If you haven't seen the first half of it, you should read it.
Yeah.
Because it is one of the few books that I've read in my entire life where at the end I was like, I wish that was twice as long. It was like heartbreaking that it was over.
But it is as long as The Stand almost.
It's incredibly long. I would say it's better than The Stand.
I think it is, yeah. The Stand is more like sprawling and sort of like a just like a triumph of writing, yeah. But it is like page turner, just like amazing things you don't see happening, coming of age stories.
It's a coming of age story. And it's just like, it's just this multi-layered thing that it's like, you know, you're seeing the entire lifelines of these characters and it's just heartbreaking. And oh my God, it's so, so good. But Pet Sematary was really good too.
If you want a really scary one, that's the one. That's the scariest one.
Yeah, Pet Sematary.
I don't want the scariest one.
I don't recommend that to most people.
Freak you the fuck out.
I think 112263 is a crowd pleaser.
Oh my God, so good, yeah.
And that's sort of like, it's relatively classic Stephen King, but it's a little less...
not scary in any way.
Yeah, way less scary. It has like romantic moments, which he's actually like, well, you got a little bit of that with the parents in the hotel room. Yes. But I also think...
Lisi's story is so romantic.
I know, but Lisi's story is another weird one that like, if you're not into Stephen King, it's a weird entry point. I usually recommend the classics. Like I think Carrie is really good.
Salem's Lot was good.
Salem's Lot. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I think it depends. Think about what you want and then we'll.
Oh, different seasons to four short stories. It's great.
Yeah. There's a lot. If you want like short stories or novellas, my favorite short story one is the, Everything's Eventual. Mm. It's really good.
I don't know if I read that one.
Anyways, you can see I have a large collection if you ever want to borrow something.
Yeah. I'm definitely intrigued by it. I have to say.
Oh my God.
It is
so good.
It is a really good choice.
But also, yeah, 112263 is another amazing.
Yeah, and
amazing.
Slightly less long and epic.
Yeah.
Anyway, great. Thank you all for being here on my triumphant return back to my podcast. If I manage to get this one out, who knows? Maybe I'll edit the other ones that I have sitting around waiting and maybe there will be more episodes.
Cool. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's been an honor.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Whether
Bye.
I'm alive or not when this is published.
We'll see.
We got the save.
And you will find and we can party like it's 6/1999.
Do a little mini ad for Red Bull and say what you just said.
Well, I was just saying that we got a little vodka Red Bull right here.
This podcast is sponsored by...
This podcast is sponsored by Vodka Red Bulls. What did I say? This podcast is sponsored by Vodka Red Bull. It'll make you forget about the problems you have, or... Wait, what did it...
It'll either fix your problems.
You have a future in this.
You just said it, and it was great.
This podcast is sponsored by Vodka Red Bull. It'll either solve the problems you have, or give you problems bigger than the ones you got.
Vodka Red Bull. That's what it sounds like when you drink one.
Vodka Red Bull. I've had a bunch of them.